It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Ann Strainchamps. Today we're asking, in the face of climate change, can we find hope? And you've read the headlines. Brutal storms, heat waves, rising sea levels, and droughts. The future is looking pretty scary. But there are some ecologists and environmentalists who think we're telling the wrong kind of story about the big problem of climate change.
It's not a big problem that kills the human spirit. It is feeling useless. It is feeling powerless. So all of these messages that we hope will motivate people, we have to present them in a way that shows a sense of possibility, that engages them in being part of the solution, all of us as being part of the solution. And that's really the passion of my life.
Frances Moore LePay is best known for her 1970s book, Diet for a Small Planet. She's been at the front lines of the sustainability movement for decades. And her latest book, EcoMind, is less about carbon footprints and more about how we frame the future. She remembers the day she realized that environmentalists were getting the climate change message all wrong.
I walked out of an enormously impressive climate conference a few years ago where all these top speakers, my heroes, all presented. The audience kept dwindling as the conference went on. And I walked out the door on the last day and I thought, wow, has lead landed, implanted in my bones? I could hardly move. I was so paralyzed. And I thought, wait a minute, this isn't working. And so I set out to reframe the challenge. And that had a lot to do with reframing hope itself.
Well, so for example, one of the constant refrains when we talk about climate change is the planet has limits. There's a limit on how much CO2 we can pump into the atmosphere. There's a limit on how many pesticides or fertilizers we can wash into the oceans before everything starts to collapse. What's a more hopeful or productive way of talking about that?
Well, this hitting the limits is really very negative, and it's inaccurate because it's not the Earth's limits that we've hit. We've hit the limits of the disruption that human beings can cause without enormous loss. And the alternative is a frame of alignment. Let's align with the laws of nature, and we know how to do that. And with food, which is the centerpiece of my life's work, I realized that as we align with the laws of nature, we actually can increase output where needed. We can do so in a way that is not harming us, the farm workers, the farmers with chemicals, and we can protect biodiversity. I'm thinking about what we're learning, for example, with agroforestry, which is simply the integration of trees with cropped land. We could sequester carbon equivalent to about a third of greenhouse gas emissions in 2007. Agroforestry, it has re-greened an area the size of Costa Rica in southern Niger, which has looked almost desert-like a few decades ago. And now with 200 million trees growing there with crops, they have achieved food security for about 2.5 million people. This is not some new technical fix. It's about absorbing the lessons of nature and going with that.
Well, and going back to storytelling and the way we frame the story, why don't we hear more of the success stories? They kind of get drowned out.
I know. I wish I knew the answer to that. I think I'm sure have heard, if it bleeds, it leads in journalism. And I think there's an underappreciated hunger for solution stories. When we tell a story of solutions, people are riveted and they want to share that. So these stories of possibility, like the one I just shared about Niger. When I start to despair, I think, oh, yes, well, I would never have predicted what happened in this African country I just described, so I better not say the next thing is impossible.
You know, one inescapable aspect of climate change, surely, is that those of us who have the luxury of living in places like North America are going to have to cut back on our habits of consumption. You know, and for people who've grown accustomed to a certain standard of living, that can be a bitter pill to swallow. So how do you reframe that one?
Well, I think a lot of us are also very burdened by the way of life that we're locked into. For example, if public transportation were easily available, it's so much less hassle than payments on car insurance and car repairs. And it's a matter of our understanding that actually these changes that we are making can actually make life easier for us.
One of the most hopeful threads that runs throughout your book, EcoMind, about how addressing climate change might mean empowering people around the world to make a difference. You know, for example, maybe by putting solar panels on their homes to sell electricity into the grid, that might actually wind up shifting how political power is distributed around the globe. Can you explain?
Well, it's could be that solar got monopolized, but it's very much more difficult. I mean, when you think about oil is concentrated in the ground, it takes millions, billions to bring it to the surface and to distribute it. That has led to a very highly concentrated industry, where solar is virtually everywhere, and we can all be producers. So there is an inherent in renewable energy, an inherent kind of democratic element of distributed power. And another aspect of this that I think is so important from a food perspective, presently our agricultural system contributes about a quarter of all greenhouse gas emissions. And yet we know that agriculture can be a great carbon absorber, and agroforestry in particular, I mentioned earlier. So the poorest people on Earth, that is farmers in the global south who make up the majority of the world's hungry, they can be encouraged and enabled through just initial small loans and education to learn better ecological farming practices that store carbon in the soil. They are part of the solution. They become the climate heroes. In rural India, I've been so excited about reading there of thousands and thousands of villages moving to non-pesticide agriculture. Yes, it's ending hunger, ending poisoning by pesticides, but it also is sequestering more carbon.
You know, it's interesting listening to you talk. I have the sense that you believe that addressing climate change, rather than reducing our lifestyle by, I don't know, cutting down on the number of hamburgers we eat or the cars we drive, may actually give us a better quality of life, and for people all around the globe, not just here in the developed world.
Potentially, absolutely. I mean, we have to recognize it's not like everything is great now, right? Nobody thinks that way, I think. It's not as if it's working. It's not working.
The 1% might be happy.
Maybe, but they're afraid they're going to lose it. I don't know how happy they are.
Are you suggesting that humanism needs to be part of environmentalism in a way that it hasn't maybe been in the past?
Well, I'm suggesting that we haven't really thought of ourselves like organisms, other organisms in the ecosystem, and that we too respond to our context. I often fear that people who are gripped with fear, despair about the climate crisis, believe that somehow we have to change human nature. We're too materialistic, we're too greedy, that something about our nature has gotten us into this situation. We have to step up and say, okay, what are the conditions that bring out the best in this species? And it's pretty clear to me. The dispersion of power, the transparency in human relationships, we all do better when things are transparent, and when we all take mutual accountability and drop the blame game.
Frances, I know you've spent your life working on change, but I'm curious, do you yourself personally, privately, at night, when you're all alone, really feel hopeful about the future?
Hope is not maybe not the right word for me. I have a sense of always a sense of possibility because, as I say, the things that I see today, you know, when I was born, Hitler was still alive. So how can I say that, no, this cannot happen? This meaning a positive turn. And of course, with young people, my grandchildren in my life, I really need to stay in that sense of possibility. You know, one of my favorite stories that does relate to climate change is Wangari Maathai. Wangari Maathai planted 7 trees on Earth Day in 1977. Her husband divorced her because the kitchen was too messy, too many seedlings growing, because she started this green belt movement, planting 20 million trees in Kenya, villagers all over the country. Once when Gari was given the Nobel Peace Prize, her stature rose and she connected with the UN Environmental Program. They started a Plant for the Planet program of 1 billion trees a year. And I thought, oh man, that's so optimistic. They could never do that. Well, you know what? That was 2007, and we're now at 13 billion trees planted by people all over the earth. And I go back in my mind and think, well, that was when Gari, 1977, planting her 7 trees. And so, you know, I keep that alive in me, that sense of you never know.
Francis Moore-Lepay's book is called Eco-Mind, Changing the Way We Think to Create the World We Want. And in case you want your own inspiration from Wangari Maathai, you can find our interview with her on our website. That's ttbook.org. Turns out there's a lot of debate right now over whether it's okay to feel hopeful in the face of climate change. Science writer Emma Maris was one of the first to argue that to slow carbon emissions and get ready for the challenges ahead, we're going to need some hope. In her book Rambunctious Garden, Maris writes that it's not just newspaper headlines and environmental campaigns that need to change. She says ecologists and conservationists also need to rethink just what nature is. Steve Paulson started out by asking Maris whether she thinks environmentalists are pessimistic.
Yes, I think they are. Many of them are. And I don't think that's necessarily a new phenomenon. I think a certain amount of pessimism and negative ideas about the future have been part of what it means to be an environmentalist for quite some time.
And do you share that pessimism?
Well, I do think that there are grave problems facing us, and I do think climate change is a scary thing, and I think it's very appropriate to be nervous and worried and to want to take action. But I also think that there are areas that we can be optimistic about. And I do think that there is some reframing that we can do so that the future doesn't seem like a guaranteed failure. If you think about nature out there as having certain qualities and properties, and if some of these properties that you feel it must have include that it look the way it did in the past, that it sort of be unchanged or historically accurate, then climate change means that it's very likely that we're going to lose that look and feel of a lot of places. And so if that change is unacceptable, if all change to natural systems is unacceptable, then we're basically guaranteeing that the future will be a grim place. But if we see those changes as possible positive adaptation, and if we look around and see these new landscapes as wild places and beautiful places, then there's a possibility that we'll have some good places in the future.
Well, that's an interesting way of looking at it, because most biologists, when you ask them about their potential scenarios for the future, I mean, they see a rather grim picture. I mean, you know, species going extinct, ecosystems getting wiped out.
In some ways, this reframing is my attempt to help forestall some of that. Now, species extinctions, that's a tragedy when a species goes extinct. As far as ecosystems being wiped out, I think that's where it gets kind of interesting. Because if an ecosystem changes, if new things come in from abroad or species move their ranges in response to climate change, does that constitute being wiped out or does that constitute just changing? I see kind of surprising and interesting wildness in some of these landscapes that ecologists have often dismissed as sort of being trashy because they are filled with non-native species.
Can you give me an example?
Sure. There are some places on, say, the Big Island of Hawaii where you walk into the forest and there's mango trees there and there's Asian sword ferns, Native Hawaiian plants as well, Australian ironwoods, and they're all kind of growing together in this diverse forest. You know, if you were an ecologist from Mars, you wouldn't necessarily know that these were all non-natives. You'd see a pretty beautiful jungle. But if you're a trained tropical ecologist, you tend to see this as a disaster.
So part of your project is to sort of break down this distinction of native species good, invasive species bad.
Yeah, I think so. Obviously, there are non-native species species introductions that have been total tragedies. The brown tree snake in Guam wiped out a dozen forest birds forever, and that's horrible. But interestingly, if you look at the data, most species introductions don't become these kinds of disasters. And some of them, we are actually finding strange and interesting ways in which non-natives and natives can kind of form new mutualisms. There's the case of the endangered southwestern willow flycatcher, which is now nesting primarily in non-native shrubs. So it becomes more complicated. And as the climate changes, everything is going to move around, and nativeness is going to become a much squishier concept.
Now, there is a word that has come up where some of these debates get played out. It's the Anthropocene.
Right.
Tell us what the Anthropocene is.
Well, the Anthropocene is an interesting concept, and I think it's raised some hackles. It is fundamentally just a descriptive concept. It's saying, okay, in 2014, many of the sort of fundamental Earth processes are determined by humans. And, of course, climate change is in some ways the ultimate expression of that. So the Anthropocene is not an endorsement of this necessarily. Before we figure out where we're going to go and how we're going to cope, we need to know where we are. And where we are now is in the Anthropocene, the age of man.
Well, and then there's a huge debate about whether this is necessarily a disaster.
Yeah, I think that we have to be open to the possibility that there can be some positive outcomes here. I just think it's a terrible tragedy to say to our children, anytime humans touch nature, they ruin it. Humans have touched all nature, therefore all nature is ruined. Have fun with that. You know, I just think that's too miserable of a future to hand down to our children. We can still have wild places. We can still have incredible diversity. We can still protect species. We can move away from kind of mindlessly affecting the Earth and start trying to be more conscious about the way we affect the Earth. But we're not going to ever be able to go back to a world where humans are not one of the profound drivers.
But I guess the question then is, if we see that climate change is starting to profoundly affect certain habitats, should we try to engineer particular ecosystems to make them better, to make them so that they can survive?
I think that that's already happening. I mean, and sort of practicing conservation biologists and ecologists are using the term resilience a lot. You know, if you're managing a forest and you're trying to figure out what kind of fire regime to have, and you might look at climate forecasts and say, there are some dry, hot times coming. So instead of trying to manage this for one type of forest, we might let it transition over to another type of forest that can handle this sort of more frequent fires, for example.
What does that mean to let it transition over to? I mean, you're talking about actually planting different trees that are, you know, can handle fire better?
That would be pretty extreme to actually plant different trees. Much more often, it's the case of letting changes that are underway unfold on their own. So if you have new tree species moving into your area, your first impulse as a conservationist might be to say, let's rip them out. But maybe the reason they're showing up is because your climate is getting more amenable to that species. And in fact, they might need the space. They might be having trouble at the southern end of their range. So you might welcome those trees. You might let those trees start to grow and reproduce in your area, even though they weren't there historically.
Now, the response that you'll get from some ecologists is that, yes, humans have always affected nature. And yet,
Right. If
humans start to try to engineer nature, I mean, that's the height of arrogance. I mean, that's folly.
So, yeah, at some level, I pretty much agree with that. And that's why I advocate sometimes not trying to freeze places in time and to actually let them change. So I think that what we're going to end up doing, I hope, is a real medley of levels of intervention.
I'm wondering if we should also consider our relationship with nature spiritually or aesthetically. Do we have to deal with that here?
Yeah, and I, to be honest, that's something that I have personally been very reluctant to deal with because I am a science journalist and I'm a science nerd. But you can't really avoid this question of values because ultimately when you decide to manage this way or that way, it's all because of what you want, and what you want depends on your value system.
Tell me about your own relationship then. I mean, your spiritual relationship with nature.
So one thing that this whole project has done for me is kind of give me my nature back. I mean, I grew up in Seattle and I had a very nature-loving childhood that involved a lot of scrubby city parks and kind of empty lots. And at a certain point, I got educated that this was not good enough nature, really. It wasn't the wilderness. It wasn't pristine. It wasn't old growth. I kind of checked out a little bit from nature for quite a while because I thought, well, if I'm not in a national park or if I'm not seeing like really big flashy animals, then it doesn't really count as nature. since I've sort of started to take a kind of a broader view of what counts as nature, I've just sort of seen it all around me kind of explode. The diversity of the city and the diversity of second growth forests, there's stuff living there. So it's kind of enriched my world in a pretty profound way.
It's fascinating. I mean, you're kind of saying that you got your sense of hope back. Do you think if more people changed their notions of nature, their ideas of nature, it would actually generate more activism, more will to confront the realities of climate change?
Absolutely. Because if we tell ourselves as a culture the story that the only thing we can do is delay the ultimate day in which all wild places are sullied by climate change and by human touch, then we're asking people to sign up for this sort of hospice nursing project of sort of ushering nature to its grave. And that is not a compelling cause that people want to join. But if we say we can protect species, we can increase the amount of land that's undeveloped, we can have these flourishing natures, then we're asking people to join a cause that is optimistic, that is productive and proactive.
Emma Maris's book is called Rambunctious Garden, Saving Nature in a Post-Wild World. Later this hour, Johannesburg, Copenhagen, Kyoto will peek behind the scenes at international climate summits. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Maybe one way to start thinking more proactively and more hopefully about climate change is to make it fun. But climate change, fun? Here's Barnard College environmental science professor Stephanie Furman on the story of Future Coast, a game about climate change.
We wanted to figure out a way for people to place themselves in the future. It's really hard with climate change because it's, you know, a long-term issue. There's so many causes for it, and there's so many different implications. And we thought that if we could find a way for people to actually think of themselves in various futures, maybe that would be a way to bring the issues home to them. So what you do is you can listen to or leave a voicemail for any time between 2020 and 2065.
Hey, sweetheart, it's Rob. I'm going to be home late tonight. There's a storm coming up the Jersey Shore, and they're expecting the turnpike to be underwater for a couple hours. Let Jackie know for me. Last time she stayed at work, had to walk back over the bridge in the storm. And if they have to evacuate the Rockaways again, I don't want Jackie in the middle of that. There's so much dengue and bird flu these days. All right, make sure everyone's sleeping upstairs tonight, and I'll get there when I get there. Love you.
The premise for the game, you know, there needs to be something that brings these voicemails, you know, into the present. And so there's a glitch in the system, and voicemails from the future, they're being presented to Earth right now. And what's interesting is just in that sort of a 30-second snippet or a one-minute snippet of a voicemail, there's this whole backstory that needs to be in place. They're talking to somebody, which is interesting, too. So what's the interaction between them and the person that they're leaving the voicemail for?
Hey, David, listen, it's me. I just got a call from Mom, and she said Dad's flipping out again. He's going on this time about he doesn't want to contribute to the destruction of the planet, and, well, basically, he's not letting her turn on the heat. I think all the latest news reports, I think they're getting to him. But, you know, I can't get over there today because I'm stuck in the snow. Can you try to go over there and maybe talk some sense into him? Okay, David, thanks. I'll talk to you later. Bye.
As you might suspect, in creating a voicemail for somebody, often it's for somebody you loved or you cared about. And so about 60% of the voicemails were actually had a personal side to them. A little over a third had something to do with societal changes. And then what was interesting for us was a third focused in on technology. One of my favorite ones is called an unhappy customer. The voicemail is actually building off a previous voicemail. So there was a voicemail, a robocall about hover homes. So these would be homes that would respond to flood events by floating, basically, by hovering. And so this voicemail, after listening to that, they came in with one saying, hey, my, you know, you guaranteed this hover home and it's not working. It's flooded.
And I'm mad as hell. The engine on this damn thing is on the fritz, and I can't fix it myself. And I've got 2 feet of water inside my hover home. This is ludicrous.
There were not as many of the sort of emergency, sort of crisis type of voicemails as we had expected. And in talking with Ken Eklund and Sarah Thatcher, who were the key designers of the voicemails from the Future Project, they were saying that in order to create an authentic voicemail, you need to be thoughtful. And when you're thoughtful, it kind of puts you in this other mode of problem solving. And that does take you somewhat out of the sort of the crisis side of things. And that's what we really hope to do with this project, is to engage people's problem solving. So it took me a while to figure out what I wanted to leave. You know, here I'm a scientist and an educator working on climate change for a really long time. And so I decided to create my own time stream where I started out saying, oh, it's great because, you know, we're working on, there's some new progress in working on protection of the Arctic environment. And I was leaving that for my grandchild, which I don't have right now. Then the next one is a very proud grandmother saying, oh, I'm so proud that you decided to do research on climate change and what we can do about it. And then the final one, it would be 2050, I'd be 94. And so there's a potential I could be leaving a voicemail like this someday. And it's saying, you know, oh, I'm so proud of my grandchild.
Oh, Eva, I'm so proud of Aiden and his work. I just can't believe that I live to see this, that ice is finally coming back. It's been a couple of years now, and it really looks like it's returning. I just didn't know that we were ever going to get to this point. We saw it go away, and now to see it come back and to know that Aiden played a role in it, it's just, I'm just so proud. Love you.
In the voicemail, it actually ends abruptly because it did choke me up, and it left this impression with me. And it really brings the future near. I never really connected the dots with my own research and my own work and thought about myself, you know, out as an older person looking back and thinking about how my child and grandchild would actually be navigating this future that we've been talking about and been concerned about for so long.
Stephanie Furman is an environmental science professor at Barnard College. You can find links to more voicemails from A Climate-Changed Future on our website. That's ttbook.org. One place where the conversation about climate change matters most is at international climate talks. For the past couple of weeks, leaders from across the globe have been meeting in New York to write new sustainable development goals. They're hoping governments around the world will sign on next year. Activist and writer Felix Dodds has been at those meetings. In fact, he's been at nearly every major climate and sustainability summit since 1990. Sarah Nix asked Dodds why, after so many missed opportunities, he still believes international action on climate change is possible.
I've always been an internationalist at heart. I guess from an early age, I believe that countries stood a better chance of solving the problems by negotiating rather than through armed conflict. And the UN processes offer an opportunity for the different views to be exchanged. And what I've found is it's the building of trust between different countries or different negotiators that is really vital to trying to find a way through what are very difficult issues that are facing the future.
So you entered this arena in about 1990, right?
I did, yes. My first meeting was on the Montreal Protocol, which actually was 89. And so that is a very good success story about how CFCs was found to impact on the ozone layer, and governments came together within a very, very short period of time. I think they found the hole in the ozone layer in 83. By 85, they'd created an international framework for dealing with it. And by 89, which is the meeting I went to, they decided a date before the end of the century to actually get CFCs out of the atmosphere.
Of course, that's a single issue kind of problem with a very clear remedy. But climate change is a whole other ball of wax.
Yeah, it is. To begin with, the issue was, did the scientists have their predictions right? Were these gases actually causing climate change?
Could you give me an example maybe of how you started those conversations with people who maybe weren't really sure that the science was bearing out? And how did you begin to broach the subject or get them on side about these issues?
I think that once you've got some of the evidence that things are moving in a particular direction, then the government officials may be taking a formal position that may be difficult, but they're underneath that trying to work out what needs to be done. So they are actually quite open to a conversation on that. How you change the policy depends on, to some extent, what the issue is. You can do it through technical briefings. You can do it through coffee bar discussions. You can take them out for a drink. One of the interesting things I find about this process is the real thirst by the civil servants from all countries to some extent to have the knowledge to be able to make better informed suggestions. So I think there's a real openness to that in these negotiations.
Well, zooming out a little bit, how do you find generally it's most successful for you to frame these issues when you're talking to people? I mean, there is a lot of kind of dire messaging, particularly around climate change, in the public sphere right now. Do you use those techniques? Do you talk more about solutions? How do you approach it?
No, I mean, I don't use the dire stuff. I think it can be very counterproductive. We're in a situation now where a lot of the policies that we need to do are understood. And the issue now is, how do we help those to be accelerated?
So it sounds like you're taking a more kind of constructive approach to these conversations. What's your sense of how decision makers around the globe feel, I mean, really feel, not think, about a future of climate change? I mean, is there a sense of impending doom? Or I know, of course, it's probably difficult to take the emotional temperature of the entire globe, but I guess that's kind of what I'm asking you for.
So I think that the people who are engaged in trying to address this are all doing it, I think, from an attempt to try and find a way through that we can all do this together. But there are problems. I mean, so one of the problems that we suffered in 2009 at the climate meeting in Copenhagen was that the US president couldn't actually sign up to anything, because whatever he signs up to has to go through Congress and has to go through the Senate if it's a legally binding agreement. And it's, I think, 60 votes you need in the Senate. And I don't think there has been any ratified since 1992. And so if the US can't actually deliver its part of the discussion, it makes it very, very difficult for the other countries to feel that they should take the burden on themselves.
So it sounds like there's a sense of urgency, but also maybe a sense of frustration?
I think the frustration is there. I think that the people are working, trying to find ways to get round the political barriers that exist.
You know, it seems like pretty quickly from the first discussion starting in 89 that the climate change conversation got wrapped up with questions of global social and economic development. How does shifting to sustainable development change the conversation?
So I think that we made a mistake at the very beginning of the climate negotiations, and I understand why the mistake was made. They approached it in a very similar way as they'd done for CFCs, you know, which was the reduction of carbon dioxide, the reduction of methane. I actually think it would have been better to go for a convention which identified work that needed to be done on agriculture, that work needed to be done on urban issues or water or energy.
Kind of those human face aspects of it.
Exactly. And you could have inspired business to come under that and start to make real commitments. And I think we would have been well on our way now to being able to deliver those targets that we'd been talking about. So the climate changes negotiations have changed a little in the more recent years, where some of those issues are now coming in. And it's hoped that these new global goals that will be agreed in 2015, which will have goals on urban issues, on goals on energy, goals on consumption and production, that they will then also have an impact on climate change.
You know, it's very curious to hear you say that, because I had wondered if by rolling human development and quality of life into conversations about climate change, we had bitten off more than we could chew.
No, I think we would have done exactly the opposite. I think if we'd have done that at the beginning of the process, then we would have inspired a generation of people at all levels to engage and find solutions. And I think by not doing that, we haven't opened the engine of change that could have happened.
You know, back in 2000, I think it was, the UN put forward a list of Millennium Development Goals, environmental sustainability along with human development. And they were ideally to be met by 2015, which is next year. And it seems like we're still a long way from meeting most of those targets. Are the goals and meeting the goals the actual end game, or is there something else?
So some of the goals have been met. The one on slum dwellers has been met, and I think the water target has been met, and some of the education ones of it. So it's a bit of a mixed bag. What it did do was it focused government development agencies on funding particularly priority areas that needed to be advanced, and I think it was successful in doing that. And the conversation we're having now is, what are the replacements for those? So these international agreements play a significant role in first sharing the best practice of a particular issue at a particular time, but then they offer an opportunity to give policy guidance on the way forward to address those issues. It can also inspire other groups to get engaged. And so the business community, particularly through the UN Global Compact, have had many of their companies commit to work on those original 8 Millennium Development Goals. And so you've had a more enlightened corporate response by those companies. With the goals that will be adopted in 2015, I think that will have the same impact. And this is where you get into the solution stuff. The more you can start to innovate, the more chances we have of addressing these issues early, and the more opportunities we have for inspiring a generation to become those new entrepreneurs that can address these future challenges early.
You know, you've been doing this work for quite a while now. I wonder if you have ever fatigue. I mean, it's a lot of issues to be keeping your eyes on. How do you personally keep yourself motivated?
Because I see in the people I talk to in the governments the same motivation, that they want to make the right decisions. I mean, what's been fascinating over the last 5 or 6 years has been the emergence of new leadership from developing countries to address these things. And I get inspired by their inspiration and their vision to try and, you know, make sure that this world is something which we can hand on to future generations in a state that we would have liked to have inherited it.
Felix Dodd's book about international negotiation is called How to Lobby at Intergovernmental Meetings. Mine is a cafe latte. When we come back, the author of Sacred Economics challenges how we think about money.
There's always more debt than there is money, so that scarcity, anxiety, and competition and the need for endless growth are kind of built into the money system.
I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
Thank you.
And now, Bookmarks, Writers on Books They Love.
I'm Benjamin Kunkel. I'm the author of the novel Indecision and a book of political essays called Utopia or Bust. And the book I'd like to recommend, because it seems to me one of the most important and least read, is a book from the 1970s called Steady State Economics, which may sound rather boring, by Herman Daly. But it's not a boring book. It's a short and excellently written book that tries to imagine what it might actually be like to live in an economy that had ceased to grow but not to develop. And the distinction between growth and development is one of the most important that Daly makes. He defines growth in biophysical terms, that is to say, the amount of natural resources that we use in a year. And development is something else. And in a way, we're all very familiar with this distinction from our own lives, in that we stop growing sometime in our late teens, but with any luck, we continue to develop. And it seems to me that unless we want to ensure an ecological catastrophe in front of us, what we need to do is to try and think of how to institute a steady state economy, which doesn't mean that things can't improve or change. In fact, they could continue to improve and change and do so all the more quickly, but that in biophysical terms, we would no longer be living beyond our means. The extent that we continue to do this, future generations won't even be able to live with adequate means. I think this is a reality that has become very clear to people and yet is not very clearly discussed. I have a friend who was at the forestry school, and he mentioned Herman Daly as one of the more sophisticated, or maybe the most sophisticated, theorists of steady state economy. So I decided I would check out the book. You know, the classical economists, whether Adam Smith or David Ricardo or John Stuart Mill, all of them imagine that eventually a society of endless economic growth would become a stationary one. And there are signs that this may be happening. And there are also signs that it should be happening, at least in ecological terms. So it seemed to me important to try and find the best book I could to read about this stuff. And I've now read a number of books on the subject, and Daly seems to me still the best of them.
Benjamin Kunkel with his recommendation, Steady State Economics by Herman Daly. You can find more bookmarks on our website at ttbook.org. And it's time for On Our Minds. So we spent the first part of this hour rethinking how we talk about climate change in the future. And that got us wondering, what could happen if we also change the way we think about money? One book that started a conversation across the country about the role of money in our lives is Sacred Economics by Charles Eisenstein. Steve Paulson sat down with its author to get the skinny.
Charles, you've written a great deal about how we might rethink our economic system and specifically how we use money. What do you see as the fundamental problem with how money shapes our lives?
Yeah, I think that the fundamental problem goes a lot deeper than is ordinarily recognized. I think it goes down to the way that money is created and circulates. Basically, to make a very long story short, it's created as interest-bearing debt, which means that there's always more debt than there is money, so that scarcity, anxiety, and competition and the need for endless growth are kind of built into the money system.
So how does this affect us in our daily lives?
Well, the phrase, there's always more debt than there is money, might resonate with a lot of people, or the experience of there never being enough money. And you look around, you know, and you can ask what seem like naive questions. Like if we're becoming more and more productive and we have more and more technology, then why does it seem that we have to work harder and harder? Or why, like on the governmental level, why are there all of these functions that in the 50s and the 60s, we could easily afford, but now we can no longer afford them?
Give me some examples of what you mean.
Well, how about public education? In the 60s, it was basically free. Tuition was very, very low. And now it's, you know, we can no longer afford to do that, supposedly. Or a lot of municipal services, libraries, parks, even police forces are being scaled back.
So what has changed since the 1950s or 60s when a lot of those government services were easy to pay for?
Well, we have, as you may have noticed, kind of this ongoing financial crisis that surfaced in 2008 and which is now still kind of simmering under the surface. But basically, more and more of our productivity is channeled toward meeting our debt obligations. And more money is in the hands of people or banks, you know, corporations who don't need to spend it.
Hmm. Now, you've written a book called Sacred Economics, which I have to say sounds kind of like an oxymoron here. But are you talking about finding a way to make money sacred?
Yeah. You know, I asked the question, why does it seem that money is the enemy of all of the beautiful things we want to do? And why is it that when you ask, why are we destroying the rainforests? You know, why are we doing all these terrible things on the planet? Somebody's making a profit from it. And on a personal level, too, for many, many people, the beautiful, noble, generous thing that you want to do in your life, there's not a lot of money in that. And the money, you know, on some level is destructive, but hey, man, I got to feed my family. Why shouldn't money be aligned with what's good and beautiful and sacred? That's the starting question.
So how do we do that? I mean, how do we align money, buying things, selling things to correspond to our values?
You can buy green products, fair trade products. You can try to align your purchasing decisions with your values. But at some point, you realize that the whole system is complicit in ecocide and that systems change is necessary, too. It's not just about changing personal habits. One of our new values, which, of course, is also a very ancient value, but it's care for the planet. But our economic system encourages the opposite. Very often, you can pollute, you can emit carbon or emit sulfur dioxide or draw down aquifers, and you don't pay the costs. Future generations pay the costs, but you get the profits. So one thing that we can do to realign is to internalize these costs. Green taxes, perhaps a carbon fee and dividend, so that the best ecological decision can be aligned with the best business decision.
What about at a more personal level? I mean, just in terms of how we use money in our day-to-day lives, is there a way we can construct our lives so that money is not so all-important, sort of always there hanging over us?
I think a lot of people want to reclaim some of life for money. You know, we pay for things today that a generation ago, or especially 100 years ago, people didn't pay for. For example, when I was a kid, we didn't really pay for food preparation. Mom cooked, and occasionally we'd go out to a restaurant. Today, something like 60 or 70% of all meals are prepared outside the home, either at restaurants or supermarket delis, you know. So this is a human function that's been monetized and that a lot of people want to reclaim. There's a whole movement called reskilling that involves relearning these ways of taking care of ourselves and each other without paying somebody to do that.
Are you talking about cooking classes or something more elaborate than that?
Well, I mean, it could be learning how to fix things, learning how to build things, child care co-ops, tool libraries, you know, instead of every house having their own set of power tools. Like, how often do you use your electric drill?
Right.
You know, like 15 minutes a year, maybe. So why not have like a, you know, a big tool shed in the middle of the neighborhood where everybody goes to?
So, I mean, it sounds like what you're really saying is we need more of a sense of community built into daily life. Because, I mean, of course, the thing that money allows us to do is we can just go out and buy whatever stuff we want. And we can do that basically without having to interact with other people in a meaningful way. And you're saying that's the root of the problem here.
Well, it's pretty deep down, you know. A lot of people really want to have community, but they also want their financial independence. Those two things are contradictory. I think that the economic crisis is rooted in a much deeper crisis and a much deeper transition. I call it our deep mythology. Why are we here? What is a human being? What's important? The dominant mythology today is of the separate self. You know, it says who you are is a separate individual in a world that is other, that's really indifferent to you. And the more you control, then that's less for me. So more for you is less for me. So we're all in competition with each other. But I think that that's changing. So in a community, it's not true that more for you is less for me. In a community, your well-being enables you to contribute more. So that's to my well-being as well.
Well, you've written about what you call a gift economy. What are some of the elements of that?
A gift economy consists of the ways that people take care of each other that are not mediated by money. And it's not barter either. A gift, you give it without being in control of what you were going to receive.
So it's not, I fix your car so you will paint my living room.
Right. But if I fix your car and I contribute to the community in other ways, then I feel secure. And I know from watching everybody else and watching how the community works, I know that those who do that, if they are in need, they'll be taken care of too.
Are you advocating abolishing money?
No. I guess you could say I'm a degrowth advocate. I think that the monetized realm needs to shrink, but I do think that it has its proper domain.
So play this out for me. So what would be, in your ideal world, what would be the kinds of things that we would spend money on, and what other things would happen without any money involved?
Well, I think that anything that requires a global or at least a translocal coordination of labor and resources is going to have to be mediated somehow by money. Like electronics, computers, automobiles, anything that requires a vast division of labor across the planet is going to require money. But a lot of functions that could be local and should be local today are also translocal, especially the production of food, the production of building materials, the production of entertainment to a large extent. When I go to less, quote, developed countries, I find that people sing a lot more. They play a lot more. They don't purchase songs as much. And there's more sharing.
And what about for you personally? I mean, how have you, or have you, managed to somehow reduce the amount of your life that is monetized?
Well, I mean, I do a lot of my work on a gift basis. So, for example, my books are available online in their entirety. If you choose to pay me, you can. And I want to credit my publisher for being brave enough to try this. And a lot of my events are the same way. You choose the price.
It probably also means that you're not as rich as you probably could be.
Hey, yeah. I mean, I'm not getting rich, of course. But, if I hadn't put it out there, maybe it wouldn't have spread virally. Maybe a lot of our logic that says that well-being comes through control isn't true.
That's Sacred Economics author Charles Eisenstein. You can hear an extended version of Steve's conversation with him on our website, ttbook.org, where you can also find interviews on slow money, central bankers, and a whole lot more. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Wisconsin Public Radio. Sarah Nix produced today's show, with help from Doug Gordon, Charles Monroe Kane, Raymond Tungekar, and today, Will Hankus. Our theme music comes from Steve Mullen from Walk West Music. Kirill Owen is our technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer. And I'm Ann Strainchamps. Thanks for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.